For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
We just chanted the Song of the Grass Hut, and I've been working with this poem for a couple months now. We chanted a lot here, but for the past, since November, so I've been just reading it regularly and seeing what comes up. And during the Rohatsu session, we were chanting it, and for some reason this line, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between, it really stood out for me. It was like glowing. I don't know if that ever happens to you when you, like, it's sort of like, and it was also interesting because at that time, I was really having some problems with my hips in that session, and my legs, and my knee, and my back, you know, just like, it was that point where it's like, the last half of the day when all this pain is coming up. And so I was like, what does it mean to not be stuck to inside, outside, or in between when you're in pain like that? Like, and it's, you know, I wasn't in like excruciating pain, but it's very uncomfortable. And so, you know, that, and in that space, you can start to think like, well, what is outside? What is inside? What's in between? That's a really interesting one, I think, in between. Because, yeah. And is there anything else besides inside, outside, or in between? I don't know. I mean, so I've been exploring this, just like kind of letting it come up as it does throughout the day or in my Zazen practice. And so I wanted to share some of the ways I've been exploring this. So there's a lot of questions that I don't necessarily have answers to, but I just thought it might be interesting to see where I've been going with this. I don't know. And the other part of the poem that I really like, too, is if you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now, which seems to be contradictory, right? Not stuck to inside, outside, and in between, but don't separate from the skin bag here and now. So those two, like, polar or poles, I guess, have been messing with me, I guess. And I really have been going into it with this, also this other teaching of no fixed self, which in the past has always been sort of one of those things where I was like, that's not useful to me. Like, I don't know what that means. I'm not going to worry about it, right? Like, that's, I'm just like, one of those things. But for some reason, working with this not fixed self has really been coming up for me, especially in terms of my body. Or the body. We could also say it that way, too. So the sort of the way the poem goes, obviously, there's this, Shitu is sitting in his hut with the grass that he's built, and he's, you know, giving this poem. And I think there's a lot of interpretations you could have. Like, you could say, well, obviously, in a literal sense, he's inside of a hut, and there's the outside world, and then what's in between? Is it the grass hut? Is that in between? I don't know. Ben Connolly, in his book that's called Inside the Grass Hut, which really goes into detail on all the lines of this poem, he talks about it in terms of Yogacara, right? Yogacara, or the mind-only school. And the only thing I know about that is the two words I just said, Yogacara and mind-only school. So I don't know that much more about it. But outside, he talks about as being the outer circumstances of our lives, like the conventional world. Inside is Zazen practice or meditation practice. And in between is realization or enlightenment. And I thought that was pretty good, but it didn't really help me that much. I was like, yeah, okay. It seemed like one of those things that's out there. And I was really focused on my body. So so just thinking a little bit more about it, I realized I was also reading into the poem, not that it was there. I was reading it as there is no inside, outside, or in between, which I realized, oh, it's actually not stuck to inside, outside, and in between, which I think is really interesting because then Shitu is actually saying, well, there is an inside, an outside, and in between, just not be stuck to it. Don't, which is really hard not to be stuck to all these things. So, and thinking about, there's like a lot of ways we can be stuck. We can be stuck where we are in our lives. We could be stuck in our careers, relationships, our practice. And I think, again, all these are useful things to explore, but I don't have that much time. So I'm going to focus on the body. And so last week, Taigen was talking about Dogen's term, Shinjin Datsuraku, or dropping off body and mind. And I realized that it's dropping off body and mind. And I had always read that as dropping off body and mind. Like, I was really focused on the mind part of it and realizing that a lot of my Zazen practice is really focused on the mind and sort of like leaving out the body, or the body is something that I pay attention to when it hurts. you know, and that's, so it was kind of interesting, like this sort of like, oh, it's body and mind. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Taigen, he kind of put these two together, right, in his own way. Like, so Shinjin is body mind. So I think in English, you wouldn't put body and mind, you'd put body hyphen and hyphen mind. So putting these things together, is that correct?
He states that they don't see them as separate.
Yeah. So.
But we do.
Mm-hmm. But that sort of like hyphen kind of helps me think of it as one thing, not separate. And then, okay, again, thinking about this dropping off body and mind, I started thinking about, well, what does it mean to drop off the body? Is it a bunch of skin bags sitting around, you know, like that? So going into this, I really realized that my body is really what is the boundary between me and the rest of the world, at least mentally. There's me and the world. And even in your body, there's your organs and your blood and bones. And outside of your body, there's, you know, hair and skin. And but then again, what's in between? Is the skin in between? I don't know. And so I was like, okay, that's not helpful. And then realizing, like, even inside and outside is kind of a questionable thing. Because when you breathe air in, the air from the outside world comes in and basically goes into your cells, you know? And when you breathe out, all of that goes out into the outer world. The same thing is we're doing this constantly, you know? So we're constantly this, it's almost like a permeable layer between the outside and the inside. Maybe our bodies are what's in between. The same thing is with food. You know, we take in food, it's like it comes from the outside world, we digest it, it becomes a part of us, you know, and then goes back out. So this really led me to think about no fixed self, and in a more maybe physical way, which is, like I said, it's always been a concept or an idea that's been sort of like, I can't think about that. But I was listening to I don't know if you ever listened to the podcast Radiolab. It's a science podcast, and they do really interesting stories where they ask questions, and then they ask some different scientists or experts to explain things. It's done in a really interesting way, too. But there's one about called The Elements, and there's one about carbon, and talking about how they figure, there's always been the question in biology, how old are you? And we've never been able to answer that, because if we want to answer that, we have to do some kind of really invasive thing in our bodies or some unethical things to figure out how old our cells are. But they figured out that with carbon dating, they could actually figure out how old the different parts of our body are. And what's interesting is I always think, okay, this body was born February 14th, 1971. It's changed since then, but, you know, probably for the past 20 years or so, it's remained relatively constant, right? I mean, that's, you know, it hasn't changed that much. I mean, there's some aches and pains that weren't there. My hair used to be longer, you know, things like that. But it's pretty much the same. It's pretty constant. Well, this episode of Radiolab really showed that our bodies actually are not, like, different, it's actually different ages. So our skin regenerates every 14 days or so. So this skin isn't even 14 days old. Or maybe it's 7 days. I don't know. I'm not sure. It has a birthday every 14 days. The inside of our stomach regenerates about every 5 days. And actually, I read today too, that our stomachs actually eat itself because of the acid, but we've evolved so that it regenerates fast enough so that it doesn't continue to eat itself, which is kind of crazy. Our one part of our liver could be a different age than the other part of our liver. One ventricle of our heart could be older than another ventricle. So this idea that, like, oh, this is the same body I've had for, 46 years, it's not even true. It's not even the same body I've had 5 days ago, So it's actually, even scientifically, constantly changing, and which really made me think about this no-fixed self idea. I know, your body's changing, but it's like, wow, this is really changing. It's not even, yeah. While I was thinking about this talk, I happened to look in Moon in a Dewdrop, and I saw the title of one of Dogen's essays, Body and Mind, Study of the Way. So it's like, okay, I have to read that. The first part is about the mind, study of the way, and the second part is the body. And he has this interesting quote. To study the body means to study the way with your own body. It's the study of the way using this lump of red flesh. And I really like that lump of red flesh. It's kind of like skin bag a little bit, right? It's like thinking about your body in this objective way. It's like, it's not some kind of special thing. It's like, it's a lump of red flesh. But I also think that Shitu and Dogen, it's almost like an affectionate thing. Like, oh, lump of red flesh, lump of, skin bag, like, old lumpy here, kind of like, it's like, because when you read further on in the poem, and also when you read Dogen, you see that they placed a lot of emphasis on the body and the importance of the body. He says in the next line, the body comes forth from the study of the way. Everything that comes forth from the study of the way is the true human body. The entire world of the 10 directions is nothing but the true human body. That's pretty big. I mean, it seems to be saying, and I haven't studied this text in detail, but it seems to be saying, like, the entire world is nothing but our body. Like, everything, this world, ecology, mountains, everything, that's our body, just like this is our body. And the true human body, I had to look this up, is talking about the three bodies of the Buddha. Dharmakaya, the absolute body of truth, Sambhogakaya, the bliss body, and Nirmanakaya, the body that appears in the world for the benefit of all beings. And I can't really say much more about that than that, but it's really like this cosmic, bigger thing, or maybe not bigger thing, but this body, he seems to be saying the body that comes forth from the study of the way, everything that comes forth from the study of the way is a true human body. And the entire world of the 10 directions is nothing but the true human body. So it seems to be saying that this body is really important. And even though it's just a lump of red flesh or a skin bag, it's still pretty important. So the second part of what I've been thinking about, that don't separate, is that, so we have this sort of cosmic, like, true human body, and it's constantly changing. So, but it's also don't separate from the skin bag here and now. And I think that's really important, because our bodies do exist in this time and this space in this culture, and we're marked by things like race, gender, sexuality. All those things are important. I've been reading Zenju Earthlin Manuel's book, The Way of Tenderness, and it's been really opening my mind to a lot of things. And it really explores awakening through race, sexuality, and gender is what the subtitle, that awakening through it. And I think that's because too often in spiritual communities and in the world at large, we sort of overlook this and say, oh, it's not, well, you don't have to worry about that. We're all one. people. We don't have to worry about that. You know, those, that doesn't matter in our, you know, Buddhist, you know, open-minded culture. Where really, she really talks about this is a big mistake. And when we avoid the tension and complexity of our bodies in terms of race, sexuality, and gender, we miss a really unique opportunity for awakening. Because when we don't do that, we're separating ourselves from the skin bag here and now. And we have a really unique opportunity to really look at that. She says, the body, distinct in its appearance and character, is the location of awakened experience. Inclusivity lies at the heart of understanding multiplicity in oneness as a way of tenderness, as a way of facing the challenges of the body, as the location of awakened experience. We may think that oneness should exclude marks of diversity, like race, sexuality, and gender. Yet oneness is inclusive of everything in our lives. We are interrelated despite our varied embodiments and ways of living. Race, sexuality, and gender are not merely labels or categories, but involve tangible, lived experiences for each of us. We cannot experience life without a body, and we live our lives with the categorical name given to our bodies. So for me, this raises a lot of questions as a white male, and just really painful realizations of how I just don't even realize it. That whole idea of privilege, white privilege, you know? And it just really, sometimes you think, oh, this is a book for people who are African American. But it's really a book for everyone because we all suffer from the heritage of racism, whether we're white. I think the suffering comes when you realize you haven't paid attention to this at all. That there's so many people suffering and I don't have to ever think about that, even though I should. And even though I need to think about it. So this body, not separating from this body, is realizing all of those things, I think, about white privilege, about being male, in a culture that definitely does not necessarily always support women. That's another talk, I think, maybe. So another thing that has come up with as being head Doan, as someone who trains people in the Zen forms and rituals, is how important this lump of red flesh is in the Zendo, in what we do. That our bodies are a vehicle for awakening, and it's a way that we can express our Buddha nature. And Taigen's really excellent essay, Zazen as Enactment Ritual, he talks about how Zazen shares with Vajrayana Buddhism the enactment, this is a quote, sorry, enactment of Buddha awareness and physical presence. So just sitting in Zazen in the posture is an enacting realization. And we can't sit in without our bodies, you know, in this posture. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have to sit with full lotus or anything, obviously. But that when we do this, we're expressing this awakened body and mind, just sitting here. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Taigen, like, even if we don't realize it, we're still expressing awakened experience. Even if we're not thinking about that, we're still expressing awakened experience, just putting our bodies in this posture, which is pretty amazing, really, when you think about it, or don't think about it. That we're always expressing ourselves as Buddhas, whether we realize it or not. And we have the opportunity with the Zen forms and rituals to sort of play at doing things in an enlightened way or in a way that expresses realization. And I say play because I think of rituals as a way that it's like a play. It's like kids. Like when my girls were younger, they had lots of little rituals they had. I wouldn't have called it that then, but they kind of did things in the same way. When we're bowing or when we're doing anything in here in a ritualized way, it's sort of like a way of playing with this space, playing with our realization, I think. I'm not sure another way to say it. And in Zazen, like I said earlier, I don't usually put that much emphasis on my body unless I'm in pain. I'm always thinking, it's always so focused on the mind. And I think that's partially part of our culture. You know, Descartes, I think, therefore I am. We're very focused on the mind. And so to put that attention on the body is really kind of alien, maybe, or foreign. But paying attention to the posture, as I've been doing, it's been really interesting that I can be walking, I'm a teacher, and I'll be walking in the halls at school, and the posture will somehow come back to me. It's really strange. The sitting posture, I'll just feel like, oh. And I'm not sure where that comes from. It's not from my mind, I don't think. I think it's my body telling me, calling me, or something. I don't know. Or I'll be in a lesson with lots of kids all over the place, and all of a sudden, it'll just come back to me like that sort of posture. I don't know if that happens to anyone else or not, but it's like, where does that come from? You know, is it my body actually bringing me back? So I tried to play with this a little bit in Zazen, and instead of worrying about my mind and thoughts and letting go and all that stuff, important of course, I just didn't worry about that and just focused on my body and to see what happened, like a little an experiment. And what was interesting is that even when I would be way somewhere out in some thought, and I would come back without trying to, without any kind of focus or anything. And I kind of I think it might be the body just coming back. Like if you give that posture, the cow the wide pasture, you know, that quote from Zen Mind is Beginner's Mind. Your body kind of calls you back. I mean, I think that's what it is. I'm still exploring. But your body can just call you back. So our temple forms, too, which I think is an interesting term that we call it temple forms. A form is like a body, right? It really emphasizes the physical. And I think I haven't given it much thought until I had Doan. And thinking about, well, what does this all mean and everything, and really realizing that it's another way that we can emphasize our physical and let the mind come later. So when we're bowing to the cushion, we can really just pay attention to the body bowing and not really worry about what's going on in our thoughts, or we'll just let it go. It's a way that we can relate to the other bodies in the room in a way that expresses realization. Just bowing to each other does that already. Or just talking to each other in the kitchen does that already. And it made me think about, so how do I actually relate to people in the Zendo? How do I relate to objects like cushions, altars, floorboards, and doors, things that aren't alive, but they're still here? I'm also on the flower rotation. So putting the flowers in the different places which I didn't notice ever before, but now that I do it, I'm like, oh, wow, that's a great one right there. Someone did a good job. And flower arranging is not something that I've really spent a lot of time doing in my life. I usually cut the stems and put them in and then, you know. But what's really interesting is how I've relating to flowers and cutting them and figuring out, okay, this would be a good shape for this vase because of the long stem, and I'll put some of these smaller ones here, or the colors, or just relating to these objects because it's here, it helps bring out that idea of expressing realization, of expressing the active presence of Buddhas, you know, it's just really interesting. It's almost like the flowers then start to talk to me a little bit. Like I'll put them off to the side, and after I've done, and I'll kind of look at it, I'm like, oh, I need to change that. Or like, ooh, that's better than I thought it was. You know, and so it's like how, it's just really interesting how this happens. And then I started thinking about outside of the Zendo, what rituals do I follow? what routines does my body already do that I'm not paying attention to that are actually pretty important or could be ways that I could express this realization. Like, what do I do in the morning when I wake up? That's probably the time that I'm on autopilot 100%. I'm the kind of person that I lay out all my clothes the night before. I wake up, put them on, and go, you know? So that's a ritual, though, really, like laying out my clothes the night before so I can be prepared the next day. You know, making coffee, all that kind of stuff. So, like, starting to pay attention to those little rituals that my body already does that I'm not even paying attention to. And then another thing about Zazen that I was been thinking about is sometimes it seems we're facing the wall, our backs to each other. It can seem a little self-centered, maybe. Or maybe we're all introverts. We don't want to look at anyone else. I don't know. But that facing the wall actually implies a sense of trust with each other. We have our backs to everyone in the room. And in everyday life, that can be dangerous, you know? I mean, at least feel unsafe, you know? Especially if we don't always, like, I came in here a little bit earlier, and I didn't know how many people were in the room, you know? I didn't know. I heard some people walking in, so that could be a little unsettling. But I've been realizing that even though it looks like we're facing the wall alone, we're not sitting alone here, or maybe anywhere. We're not sitting alone. We hear, it's interesting, like, I started to notice, like, people a sigh, or a stomach gurgle, or a shifting. And I think, I used to think like, oh, that's a distraction. But now it's like, no, that's other bodies here sitting together. This is a communal practice. And especially in Sesshin, sometimes you'll be sitting next to someone and you'll notice that they're like, you can just tell they're in pain. Like, you can tell. And so it's kind of interesting to, like, you're sitting with them in pain, like, or in discomfort at least, you know? And that's very touching. I think it's that tenderness that comes out, the vulnerability, opening yourself up to someone else's pain, and maybe like telling them, okay, you got this, you know, like in your mind, like a little bit of like sending them some energy, you know, or I don't know. And I think that opening to your own pains and those of others really, you know, in Sesshin is really interesting, but then when you go outside in the outside world, it's like really vulnerable. I feel really, after the first day or two after a Sesshin, even though I've been focusing so much on my own body pains, like suddenly I just notice everyone is in pain, you know? Everyone is suffering. And that connection of my body with their body, you know, really opens up this. And it's not something I say, hey, I bet you're in pain, you know? Nothing like that. You look like you're in pain today, you know? Not like that, but it's more like you just sort of like, it's like a connection that I don't usually think of or realize. So, to wrap it up, how is understanding no fixed self and the body helpful? How is understanding not fixed to inside, outside, and in between, and not separating from the skin back here and now helpful? When Ruth Ozeki was here, she discussed a line from Dogen's Uji, which is being time, right? And I'll just read the quote. The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. Know that there are myriads of forms and hundreds of grasses throughout the entire earth. And yet each grass and each form itself is the entire earth. Kind of like that quote from before. The study of this is the beginning of practice. I have a little ways to go before I'm at the beginning of practice, I think. But the word arrays really caught my attention, because as a teacher, we teach arrays as multiplication. You make these little counters and you say 4 rows of 3 is 12. So you've multiplied 4 times 3 is 12. And what that made me realize is this is the advantage of not thinking of having a fixed self. If you think about yourself as an array of selves, as not one single self, because when you have an array of selves, you have many more opportunities to respond to others in an appropriate way. You have many more ways that you can help someone. Or if you're fixed to your one self, which doesn't really exist anyway, one self, you are sort of fixed and you always are responding with a habitual pattern. But when you have an array of self, or you can loosen that up a little bit and think of yourself as having maybe multiple possibilities, you can respond to people in multiple ways. We can respond to the world as it arises and in fresh ways and appropriate ways. And we can also see that sometimes those usual ways are helpful or sometimes they're not, and you can go with another way. So this array of self really, really helped me out too, thinking about this body has an array of self. Like, it's not a fixed body. There's multiple ways that I can respond in the world, or we can respond in the world. Yeah, so I guess my final question that I've been asking is, like, how do you express not stuck? Not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. I mean, we kind of all just did it by sitting zazen, right? I guess. And I think the way we express not stuck is that we don't separate from the skin bag, this lump of red flesh, here and now. That's my partial answer right now. I'm still exploring, so thank you.
Comments, questions, responses from us?
Thank you for the talk. I wanted to mention three things. One, it's kind of interesting, is that back in the early 60s, around 61 or 62, John Cage gave a series of concerts in Tokyo and Osaka that came to be called the John Cage Shock. And he took with him his protege, Yoko Ono, who participated in the concerts. And at that time, she was married to an avant-garde composer from Japan, Ichi Yambi. The Tokyo concerts were actually held in this very large exhibition hall that was built for the express purposes of flower arrangement competitions, actually. Mm-hmm. And you probably know flower arranging is a very high art in Japan, as high as any art can be. Along with one of my favorite Buddhists, Bobby Hill from the TV series King of the Hill. there's an episode where I think basically some Tibetan monks show up because there's a lama in their town in Texas, and it may be Bobby. In fact, it actually does turn out to be Bobby. But there's another one where he takes up flower arrangement in a competitive way, and it's very fun. But the other thing I wanted to just raise as a question is, in the whole idea of leaving off body-mind, I wonder if it's very dangerous to separate those two things, especially in the form of a duality, which would be the problem anyway, but separate them. So
separate which?
If you just leave off the body, or you just leave off the mind, and I don't mean leave off the body in terms of separating from the skin back, but just letting go of one without letting go of the other. It seems like, I know in my case, there have been times in my life where I did leave off the mind, and it turned out to be in very destructive ways. And I suppose leaving off the body in destructive ways too. And so, I'll say the third thing for another time, but I just wonder about that as a hypothesis. You better be careful too. We all better be careful to think body, mind, and not separate them and are leaving off practices, you might say.
Thank you.
Oh.
I was writing and thinking through how does one relate to one's body when one's body is swimming and how I need to relate to my body if it's going to swim. So violence, like one's body being a source of violence can like create trauma and sensation in the body because it doesn't feel like a safe place to be. And in learning how to swim, most of the people are like, actually often learning how to swim, happening in the African American, I think about, and watching them struggle how to swim, how ancestral memory from like the middle passage and slaves not being able to learn how to swim also translates into how our bodies cultivate trauma in the water and the world, like things we don't realize. And for me, this is like my fourth time trying to learn how to swim. So I have personal trauma in water and then like ancestral cultural trauma. So it's just that it's been a lot. And then like when I'm in water, I notice that I just have trouble on days when I'm like really angry or really sad or really fearful. Like if I'm hearing emotions from something else, it impacts the way that my body interacts with water and I just like, can't swim. And I especially notice that like with my fear of thing, because I was, sorry, now I can get a new bed, it's just a lot of work to cultivate a new relationship with one's body after it's been made a side of life.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yes, I like the body and all the ways in which our mind or body have been wounded or hurt.
And I think it's interesting that I didn't talk about it at all in here, but all the ancestral body that we carry with us too, you know, like... it's just really, that's even bigger, you know, like how much we carry with us from our pasts or from our grandparents or great-grandparents or, you know, all that is still here, you know.
Embodiment. Any comments?
This weekend I saw I Am Not Your Negro, which is every word in it is from James Baldwin.
Oh, yeah.
And some of what he was saying touched on that, where he was saying that there's an unconsciousness, and also that... So one of the things he says really strongly is that we all suffer from racism in different ways, and that the country can never be great without addressing racism, and that to live with so much self-deception as white people, to live with so much blindness affects our emotional honesty and our emotional health at a really deep level. And but he also talks about what a crime awful it is that so many people just don't care, you know, that all this terrible stuff is going on, and the civil rights movement is going on, and yet so many people just manage to shut it down. So that struck me because you said, you know, how you managed to be kind of oblivious a lot of the time. But also, I think realizing, that it does hurt us when we hide in that oblivious. Because we're not really unaware, you know. I mean, it's everywhere. You have to be aware of Ferguson. You have to be. So if you shut off